Okay, hit it. This is Soapbox, your alternative to superficial discussion of the issues. To 15-second soundbites, your alternative to mindless talk radio. Soapbox, the show where we talk in depth to participants in the events shaping politics and to experts on the issues.
I'm your host, Rob Turca. Andy Bickelbaum and Mike Bonanno are two of the Yes Men, politically progressive satirical pranksters. They are the stars of a documentary now out on DVD entitled The Yes Men. Andy Bickelbaum joins me on the phone now. Andy, welcome to Soapbox.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Why do you call yourselves the Yes Men?
Basically what we do is we agree with the people we actually don't agree with. The way we work is basically we set up satirical websites, and we've done this for three or four different cases. Once we set up a fake website for the World Trade Organization back in 1999, and we were shocked to find that people went to the website and didn't notice that it was satirical, that we were poking elaborate fun at the WTO. And we found ourselves invited to conferences to speak as official WTO representatives. And when we did that, we decided to agree wholeheartedly with what our audiences might expect the WTO to say. We decided to just push it further than the WTO normally would. And we hoped to get a reaction from our audience in doing that, like just by presenting them with such absurd and excessive versions of neoliberal policy. We hoped to get a rise out of them, basically. So that's why we call ourselves the Yes Men, because we over-agree with our opponents.
A lot of listeners to this station will be familiar with the WTO, the World Trade Organization, but for those who aren't, the WTO basically pursues a sort of a purist free market ideology in support of world's corporations, and the only rights that they're really concerned about are not environmental rights or labor rights much at all, but more corporate rights, say, for example, protection from copyright infringement, that sort of thing, right?
Right. The whole point of the WTO is to help business do business, and they say that in black and white on their website. And we, like many people, feel that trade should exist to serve people and not the other way around. There should be a WTO that tries to make trade and business decisions serve the interests of people, especially poor people who are increasingly burned by the global trade system such as it exists.
The documentary shows a conference in Austria where you masqueraded as a WTO official who proposed a system to allow citizens to sell their votes, and you got a surprising reaction.
Yeah, we got applause and no reaction, actually. We thought it was the logical extreme, the logical extension of WTO policy would be to, since it's all about privatizing and allowing the market to have sway over big swaths of our lives, we figured it was a logical extension would be to push it into democracy itself and have the market take hold of democracy and run it. And so the market and economic decisions would decide who would vote for who. And of course, it's already like that, but since campaigns can be financed to the tune of many millions of dollars by large corporations, but we just decided to translate it into something very direct.
Well, you should be careful what you do in Austria. You know, over there they elect former Nazis to the office of chancellor.
Well, I think we basically do the same thing here.
The end of the documentary is with you speaking at a gathering in Australia, again masquerading as a WTO representative, and you announced a radical overhaul of the WTO to be more in line with the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And the movie showed attendees reacting positively. Was that representative of that group, and was that surprising to you?
it wasn't surprising, and it was representative. They were thrilled, and that was the only reaction we got from a group of experts that wasn't surprising to us. Before that presentation, we did a bunch of satirical ones in which we pushed the discourse increasingly to the absurd, and we got basically no reaction, just kind of quiet assent. And the reaction of the Sydney accountants to our new approach, which was to disband the WTO, and just basically, when we went to Australia, we decided we wouldn't do any more satire. We would just talk as we would talk if we were in the WTO and do what we would do, which would be, of course, disband it and refound it as an organization committed to helping trade help the poor. So when we presented this solution to these people, they were naturally thrilled, as any human being would be. I mean, even people in business retain a lot of humanity, and we happen to be able to tap into that.
In between those two things I mentioned, you went on CNBC as a fictitious WTO official, and no one caught on. And I wonder if that appearance, did that give you any insight as to, is it that when you go to these conferences, no one wants to speak up as being the only one in the crowd who is outraged by, to use Pope John Paul II's words, savage, unbridled capitalism? Is it that people don't want to speak up in a crowd, or is it that there's just such a mindset that even behind closed doors, the people at CNBC weren't saying to you, what are you, nuts?
Well, people don't want to speak up in a crowd, and that's exactly what lets the WTO do what it does and lets all these corporations do what they do. I don't think there's any contradiction between that. People didn't want to stand up and say, you guys are nuts. And also, I think a large part of them, whatever doubts they may have had at one point in our lectures, or in the case of CNBC, the broadcast, they buried them because, you know, it just kept going and nobody else was reacting, and so they figured it must be okay if they had doubts to begin with.
Now, you finally got an appropriate reaction when you made a presentation at a college in upstate New York, right?
Yeah, we gave a talk in which we presented the only possible market solution to starvation in the third world. You know, a lot of people are proposing solutions to starvation and solutions to increasing poverty and so on, and among those solutions are like regulating the market more and making sure that they don't go in and wipe out indigenous forms of agriculture and so on. We at the WTO, of course, are strongly against that, and so we proposed the only market solution, the only pure market WTO consistent solution to starvation and poverty in the third world, which was recycling food, basically. It would simply allow third worlders to recycle whatever they eat. So they'd buy a hamburger, let's say, and we'd provide a filter, a small, basically coffee filter, through which they could pass the result, you know, their waste, let's call it, and eat that again and again and again, and they could derive up to, you know, five times the nutritional value of a one-time eating, and so it would become affordable for them. And before the lecture, we passed out hamburgers to the students and then told them in the middle. Mike stood up in a McDonald's outfit and said, these are prototype recycled hamburgers from McDonald's, hope you enjoyed them, and here's our system for doing it, and he showed a video. And, you know, we figured by then, when they knew that they had eaten waste, they would get upset, and they did, of course, but we didn't quite realize that they would get upset immediately. And in fact, as soon as I opened my mouth, basically, you know, started waxing lyrical about the market and how wonderful it was and how it's the only solution and how starvation is a problem because, you know, these people can't work and so on, the students were up in arms, and before long they were throwing things, and the guy who'd organized the lecture had to calm them down. And so it was a healthy reaction, and it surprised us because none of the experts had reacted at all, and we'd gone much further.
Well, I assume you were using real hamburgers, and so therefore you would have expected maybe somebody to say, hey, this is pretty good tasting waste.
Yeah, well, they were fairly real. I mean, they weren't 40% recycled waste as we told them. They were much less than that, but they were partially recycled waste, of course, since some of that stuff does get into hamburgers typically. But yes, I ate a few on stage just to demonstrate that they were tasty.
Now let's go back to, I think it was 1998, where you guys were denounced by George W. Bush for making a satirical website targeting him.
That was the first satirical website we made before the WTO one. We put up a website at gwbush.com. He reacted very heavy-handedly, sent us a cease and desist letter, complained to the Federal Elections Commission, and said that we should declare the source of our immense revenue, since obviously we had to have immense revenue to set up a website. Showed what he knew about websites. And by this time, this issue was quite well known, because every time he would do something, we would send out a big press release about it, and people found it funny that he was reacting this way. So a reporter asked him about the website at a press conference, and he said that there ought to be limits to freedom. That's his quote. Very strange thing, but a portentous one.
Let's talk about Ed Meese for a minute. Ed Meese worked for Ronald Reagan, and when he wasn't miring the Justice Department in scandal, he was telling us that there was no hunger in America, that people went to soup kitchens because they liked the food. Now, you guys had a memorable encounter with him in 2004, huh?
Yeah, we saw him. We formed a right-wing think tank and went to a giant right-wing think tank event that the Heritage Foundation, which is the biggest right-wing think tank, set up in Chicago. So there were like 600 people from all kinds of weird think tanks gathered there, and we just didn't know exactly what we were going to do there as this right-wing think tank. We just knew that this was interesting and we wanted to participate. So we spoke to people for a couple days, and it was pretty much all we could stand, but it was very interesting and the food was good. And then at the final meal, we figured out what we might do, and in between speakers, they had left the microphone on. So there were 600 people eating lunch, and the microphone was on, so I just stood up and went to the microphone and dinged on a glass, and people quieted down, and I said, I have a toast. I'd like to thank so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. And also, I'd like to make an announcement. I think we at the Heritage Foundation can agree that since we don't believe in subsidizing corporations, and they don't, a lot of these conservative think tanks don't believe that corporations should be subsidized, which is funny. Since we don't think that corporations should be subsidized, clearly George Bush is not our man, because the Iraq War is the biggest subsidy for defense industry in the history of humankind. And so clearly we need another candidate, and I suggest Ed Meese, since Ed Meese was sitting right in front of the podium there. And we got some applause, and that was that.
But Ed Meese was surprised.
He smiled. He seemed to not mind too much. He looked a bit surprised. We got his face on camera. You can see it on our website.
I've interviewed a few people from the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, I believe that's the one that Ed Meese works at, and the Cato Institute, and one from the Republican National Committee, and I generally find these people sickening to read and tiresome to listen to, but they can occasionally be unintentionally funny, like the woman from Cato who was at a loss for words when I asked her to name any federal social spending program that they supported, or the black Republican who tried to defend Trent Lott during his controversy.
At that same lunch, when I got up and gave the toast, there was a little menu card, and on it there was a statement by the president of the Heritage Foundation. He said, too often we conservatives lose hope in our project of bringing the welfare state to collapse. It's just such a dramatic thing. Who knew they were anarchists and wanted to smash the state? But that's basically what they want to do. The only programs that they actually do want to fund are the military and defense, things like police and so on. That's really all they want to fund. It's quite startling.
Well, sometimes they're... Let me ask about the petition drive that you guys had to support global warming.
Yeah, we decided to try to do something around the election, the 2004 election. So one thing we did was kind of on a lark. We went out, made a petition in favor of global warming, basically. There was this Pentagon report in 2003 that admitted that global warming was a problem and that it might have severe consequences, but it said, and this is a real Pentagon report, it said that the effects on Europe and China would be far worse than on the United States. So basically our solution here in the United States should be to fortify our borders and so on. And they even suggest an extreme solution to it, which would be if it does provoke a new ice age, which is, of course, what would cause all that damage to Europe and China, then we can always make some giant machines that pump massive amounts of greenhouse gas into the atmosphere to cause more global warming, to reverse that ice age that was caused by the first global warming. Really shocking, but all we had to do was basically write it down in a petition form. And we approached people and said, will you sign a petition supporting Bush's environmental policy? And if they said yes, we would give them a spiel about how we wanted them to sign this because it was about increasing global warming. And certainly if global warming does reach the proportions that it's possible that it will and cause a new ice age, then we've got these other solutions. And basically, we told them these things quite clearly, more clearly than I'm saying them now. And 12 out of 14 people signed the petition anyways. And the idea was, of course, that they would not sign, and then we would say, but this is really Bush's policy, and here's this Pentagon report that is about this, and this is basically what Bush is about, too. And that didn't work. So,
but some of the people did run away when you used the words support and Bush in the same sentence, right?
Well, yeah. More than half of the people, even some of the Republicans, just did a double take. They had no idea what that meant. We came up with a bunch of petitions like that in winter. In fact, we went around the country in a bus that eventually we added these crazy eyes to. It had a big picture of Bush on the side, and it said, I'm telling the truth. And we thought that would be enough. Wasn't, of course. And we added some crazy eyes to it, and eventually a big missile on the top that said, the end is near. And even then, people would come up and think we were really with the Bush campaign.
When you were doing that petition, did you think about crafting even more extreme questions to see what some people would support as long as Bush wanted it? Like, do you support President Bush's plan to send all liberals to Guantanamo?
Well, we didn't go quite that far, but we did circulate a Patriot Pledge. Actually, there's a few left, and you can find them on our website. You can download them or whatever. And you would check off the various boxes that you were willing to check off, and one of them was asserting your willingness to have a nuclear waste dump in your backyard. And there were people who checked that. It just didn't seem to matter what was on the thing. If Bush was at the top, that was good enough.
Well, that might happen here in Connecticut, because now that the sub-base in southeastern Connecticut is on the list of bases to be closed, some people in the government have proposed making the area a, quote, intermediary nuclear waste disposal site, end quote, whatever that means, intermediary nuclear waste disposal site.
Right.
But on that petition, you did find one person who caught on to your spoof. Can you tell us about him?
He was one of the first ones we went up to, and he immediately got that we were pulling his leg, and he just played along. He just played the part of the absurd Republican. And, you know, we were videotaping all of this, and so he said, well, you know, will you sign this? And he said, well, sure, I'll sign it. And then afterwards we asked him if we could use his image, and he said, well, yeah, you can use my image, but you should know that I'm mentally ill. And he went on to describe his illness. And it was quite interesting that nobody else understood that we were poking fun at Bush, whether on the left or the right. It took a mentally ill person to see that.
2004 was the 20th anniversary of the explosion of a Union Carbide plant in Bhopal, India, that left thousands dead and more than 100,000 with lifelong medical problems. Union Carbide has been acquired by Dow Chemical, which has not cleaned up the mess, has never offered more than $500 in compensation per victim for any of the victims, will not offer any compensation to the survivors who have lifelong medical problems, and hasn't even cleaned up the site. But in late 2004, Dow offered to make amends, much to its own surprise. How did that happen?
Well, about 5 days before the 20th anniversary of the catastrophe, which, as you said, is the biggest industrial catastrophe of all time, a BBC researcher contacted Dow. He went to dowethics.com and clicked on contact and asked Dow if they would speak on the BBC about the issue of responsibility for the disaster. And to the BBC researchers' enormous surprise, Dow accepted, because Dow never says anything about it. They just say, we don't have any responsibility when we acquired Union Carbide, blah, 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 blah. You know, they have a standard paragraph, and that's all they say. So when the Dow spokesperson agreed to speak on the BBC on the 20th anniversary, the researcher was very surprised, and we completely freaked out at that point and spent 5 days trying to figure out what to do, and eventually we decided to do what we did, which was accept full responsibility for the disaster and describe exactly what we were going to do to make things right, because we decided that that was the approach that would get the most press. And it did. It resulted in something like 500 articles in the United States press in a country in which many people don't even know what Bhopal is. So we felt it was a success.
Now, this was reported on the BBC as straight news, and after your hoax was discovered, the BBC invited you back for another interview. And I'm wondering if you think an American network would have done that, to bring you back after they had been duped, that they were then magnanimous or open-minded enough to say, okay, come back and tell us about how you did this whole hoax.
Well, the British have a lot of faults, but they are known for their amazing sense of humor, and they had one about it. Yeah, they wanted to talk to us and find out how we did it, and they broadcast it that evening.
It says on your website that you showed up there and there were four people smiling at you, and you said, where are the cops?
Yeah. Cause each time we do one of these things, we are pretty sure we're going to get arrested, but it never happens.
You've never been arrested for any of this stuff?
Not for this stuff, no.
Now, some of this stuff must be illegal, if not all of it, right?
Probably.
We don't really know.
We don't know. We used to ask lawyers, and some lawyers, you know, lawyers that we happen to know or that friends or friends of friends, and some of the lawyers would say, well, yeah, it's terribly illegal and you shouldn't do this. And others would say, it's probably not illegal. Go ahead and do it. And so we would trust those, and eventually we stopped asking. And in any case, it doesn't really matter whether it's illegal or not, because corporations are constantly pursuing activists for legal protest, like with the McLibel case. Of course, every day there are slap suits still, you know, various legal maneuvers to hogtie activists in various ways. So what we count on to prevent corporations from coming after us is simply embarrassment. I mean, the best thing for us would be if a corporation came after us, if they actually decided to try to sue us for telling the truth about them and for raising public awareness about them. That would be fantastic, because that would enable us to further raise public awareness about them through press releases.
You know, mainstream media has been declining in the eyes of most people, including me, as it's been subject to tighter control by the corporations that own the various organs. But you make the point, if I infer this correctly from reading your website, that mainstream journalists do a good job of covering you guys if you can justify that coverage to their bosses by creating news. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a certain respect for even mainstream journalists. I think a lot of people go into journalism because they are interested in the world, and they want to tell the truth. And at a certain point, they find that the machine, the big corporate machine, doesn't quite work that way, and they're not allowed to. But they still want to, I think. And I think when you furnish them an excuse to write about something as important as Bhopal, let's say, they jump at the opportunity. And that's basically what we do. We essentially collaborate with journalists who want to write about the subjects that we're making these pranks about, and they do.
Just one more thing I'd like to mention about Bhopal. I do remember the immediate aftermath of that disaster when Union Carbide CEO Warren Anderson flew to India as part of a phony show of concern. He was going to go there and have his picture taken and then fly back. And I laughed out loud at what happened to him when he landed in India, because he must have been shocked, since it was so different than anything that could have happened to him in this country. He was arrested for mass murder.
Right. And then he fled. He posted bail, I think it was $2,000, and left. Yeah, as part of our reparation plan, Dow announced that we would extradite Warren Anderson back to India from his retirement home on Long Island.
There's a whole lot of stuff on your website. I certainly recommend that people read through it. It's theyesmen.org. Is there anything you guys have done that you'd like to talk about that has happened since I read your website?
Well, we're just continuing on with DAO so far. We spoke at a banking conference in London a month ago and presented to them a life-sized golden skeleton. It was DAO's mascot for its new acceptable risk program, in which we outlined very precisely how many deaths are acceptable in one region of the world or another to corporations with their dangerous ventures. So, of course, you can have a number more deaths in a place like India than you can in a place like Virginia or Connecticut. And we outlined this very precisely, and to make sure people understood, we unveiled a golden skeleton, sang a little song, and, you know, described this golden skeleton as the lucrative skeleton in the closet. Look at your skeletons in the closet. Are they just skeletons in the closet, or are they actually golden skeletons? Don't jump to conclusions about killing thousands of people. It may be a good idea. And to our shock, well, it's always to our shock, but this was even more somehow, people accepted it and applauded and enjoyed it very much. And we had half an hour of conversations with them afterwards in which not a single trace of confusion or doubt emerged. One banker called it refreshing. He said specifically all these other people are talking about corporate risk in this really abstract way that we can't understand. You guys are just laying it out on the table. It was pretty shocking.
I remember at one point Union Carbide was trying to get the Bhopal liability cases tried in Indian courts instead of American courts because their lawyers estimated that the cost for human life would be 10 times as high if adjudicated in the American court. So it was more cost-effective mass death to have it handled in India. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Exactly. Yep. We weren't actually inventing anything. It's actually perfectly descriptive of what goes on.
Okay, well, look, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us here today.
Sure, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Soapbox, the show where we talk in depth with participants in events shaping politics, experts on the issue.